So my dad was in radio too.
You're kidding.
No.
Where was he?
His last job, he took WKTU from mellow to disco in the early 80s. And he called Princeton basketball and football for Nassau Broadcasting in Princeton, New Jersey. So we were all radio brats. And your dad was too, Sean.
I grew up just assuming that everybody had a father who was a disembodied voice that would come through. We all had nicknames, and he could actually modify our behavior while entertaining hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers by sliding in references to our nicknames. So it's like, you know, it's as if he was watching, you know.
So. It's sort of like Carol Burnett pulling her ear to signal her grandmother. So he would say, "Hey, Spanky," and no one would know he's sort of admonishing you.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Where did you grow up?
In White Plains, New York. He was in the city. He's at WOR. For 20 years, he did the Weekend Hit Parade with Chris Cunningham on WOR-FM. Beautiful, easy listening music.
That's great.
The only problem with that was that that's where he was every weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that. I tell people I was raised in the press box. Some more basketball by the time I was, you know, 9 years old than...
There was some who would definitely covet that type of upbringing.
Definitely. Yes. Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 19 of Insider Interviews. Today, it's all about video. Premium video, anyway. That's defined by the VAB as multi-screen content that's professionally produced programming in any form. So that could be linear, tablet, laptop, mobile, etc. And I'm talking to the president and CEO of the VAB, Sean Cunningham. He's been with the organization about 17 years, and he'll share exactly how they focus on providing resources for marketers all about that premium marketplace. It's a really important topic, and Sean has a lot to say. So here we go. So if you couldn't tell, I'm talking with Sean Cunningham, who is actually the president and CEO of the VAB, as in video. But we were here just bantering about radio as we kind of warmed up our podcast microphones and discovered something in common. So it's great to see you, Sean, or hear you.
It's great to be heard. And I think my dad would be proud that finally I'm doing something where I'm not going to be dependent on video. And it's going to be all about the voice. So, you know. It better be projection, the elocution, it better be good.
He would be proud of you. And my father as well had us raised saying, "How now, brown cow?" Did you go through that?
My dad was a grammarian of the highest order, and he's passed a long time ago. But I, unbeknownst to me at the time, married a grammarian of the highest order. There are, you know, five of us in the household, and there's nothing quite like having a full-time professional grammarian in the household. Apparently, the English language is an art. That's what I grew up with, and that's how it continues. But I'm smart enough to default to her on the technical things. So,
hence, you're happily married with three children, nonetheless.
Yes. So, just to complicate things, the youngest speaks fluent Spanish, as does my wife. And so, we're not quite sure sometimes what they're talking about, although I know enough to be dangerous. And then they can lapse into French, and then it gets complicated.
Wow. I am never coming to dinner. Well, speaking of rules of the road, some of the things that I want to talk about are, you know, what's happening in the industry, and you are the guy to talk to. And I'm going to challenge you, Sean. The VAB, as we get back into our subject of choice, describes itself as simplifying things about the industry and making it understandable, translating data into insights, basically like really helping marketers out. I mean, you go to your About Us page of the VAB and it says, "We simplify the complex." So I need you to simplify.
I think a lot of that, frankly, comes from my agency background, and a lot of the people I work with come from an agency background as well. And I came from agency media and agency management and rose through the ranks. And, you know, media was kind of my magic carpet to do that. The thing that I learned early was that if you're going to be valuable as a media person, it is understanding how media works as a lever to do one thing: sell more stuff. That's why I was told the purpose of advertising is to sell more stuff. It's actually a brutally simple business. And media is the lever to activate consumers in either the short or the long term. And I was told, like, when, you know, media people can get quote unquote lost in the weeds is when they become absolutely fascinated by all the moving parts of media and don't have the ability to complete the sentence to say, and this is why an advertiser should care. And this is the utility for an advertiser. And the purpose of this is to do X, Y, or Z inside of, you know, inside of a purchase funnel, inside of a, you know, a distribution chain. We need to understand, you know, a highly complex video media ecosystem, which we love working in. But to keep things focused, we need to look at it through a marketer's lenses that sits there and says, how are they going to go out there and find growth, which is awfully hard to find these days. So to us, simplification is looking at it through a marketer's lens and sitting there and looking at it as this is an instrument that I need to hit my brand goals, to hit my sales goals, and to build my brand. And I think when you lose sight of that is when media gets oh so complicated.
Yeah, yeah. Very well put. And I can tell that we're going to get along very well because I always say that my middle name is Wiffum, the what's in it for me. And coming from a sales marketing background at many media companies, and I knew you when it was called the CAB, as in the Cable Advertising Bureau, and look at how we've grown up now, I always preach the gospel of thinking about what your prospect or your advertiser wants out of your value proposition. The what's in it for me is what they're thinking.
I'll never forget some of the most basic things that I think of daily. Some of it, yes, yeah, some of it is the training I got on Procter & Gamble brands at agencies that helped me to this day in terms of the ways to think about really disciplined things having to do with brand building. But the things I think about more are the real retail experiences. There is nothing like, you know, being in a, you know, QSR business, quick service restaurant business, and being on the Wendy's account or the Burger King account and having a room full of unhappy franchisees who all have very specific opinions. And there is nothing like the retail end of a business, whether it's a car dealer or it's someone who's, you know, owns four franchises, or it's somebody who's got a furniture store. And it becomes real, real, real fast with those people. And only performance matters and only performance now matters. Yes, they want to build long-term equity. Yes, they want to expand this, that, and the other thing. But if they can't draw a bold line between the decisions that they can make in media now and sales by the end of the month, it's a waste of their time. And that's something that's always been, you know, sort of a true north for me, is to never lose sight that in all of this, you know, this is a lot about the science of how do you activate and mobilize customers in scale to modify their behavior.
Well, we kind of came in the side door as we chit-chatted to kick off this episode, 19 of insider interviews, and I want to give you a framework for some of the things that I want to talk about. Sean, the last time I saw you was in person in February at the VAB's Impact Conference.
Right.
But I don't think a little pandemic has slowed you guys down at all. You've, you know, published a half dozen reports. You've had a couple of other conferences. You recently did Streaming Week as a virtual conference. I'd love to get a top line on some of those recent studies. And I even want to find out things like one of those studies talks about diversity. I want you to talk about what's happening now, how we're pivoting during pandemics. So let's get into it. Why don't you give us the background, first of all, about your goals and intentions of the VAB in that simplistic way?
It's funny. You talked about February and you talked about that conference. And that conference to us was an embodiment of what our brand wants to be. And that is in the middle of the conversations, providing insights to marketers. And because we all grew up in agencies, we understood that at the end of the day, to be of use in this ecosystem, the thing that's most needed are practical insights that help build business. So everything we do, whether it's a report or it's a marketer's guide, it's a quick hitter, it's a video, it's an infographic. So the things that we produce are literally thought of, look, how do we make an assistant brand manager, a brand manager, a group media planner, somebody at an agency, somebody at a client, a category director, how do we give them the secret sauce? And we want to be their easy button. And so we want to push that conversation. We want to answer unanswered questions. And the interesting thing about since February, I had a college professor who once said, life is what happens while you're making other plans. And I don't know that anything has embodied that more than everything that happened since March 9th. Now, the good news was, because we understood the sweet spot that we served, we suddenly realized there was a void of useful information which was desperately needed. And so our shift was, certainly not in mission. We knew exactly who we are, but our output, we suddenly realized, there were a ton of unanswered questions. And so what we did was, we doubled down on production, doubled down on everything we needed to do. I was, finding myself, like all my coworkers, at my dining room table at 2 a.m, but it needed to be done. And so we started to produce, a lot of answers to unanswered questions quickly about both viewer behavior, consumer behavior. How is COVID affecting people? How is COVID affecting their attitudes about media? What role does media play in COVID? Not only that, suddenly there was an enormous amount of shifting that had to happen in multi-screen TV. Suddenly you didn't have live sports. Suddenly a whole lot of advertisers whose categories were imperiled needed immediate relief from what they were doing. Not only that, but we saw, probably like a 12-week period, there were 698 separate campaigns that were COVID related. Now people can't do fantastic slick production. They can't send crews. So everything from, how ads were produced to how quickly something went from concept to airing to, across multi-screens, how it was read, the impact on the brands. And we saw rinse, lather, repeat 690 some odd times of people. It was amazing. And, to us, because we knew, look, we are here to answer the unanswered questions. The stakes around the other unanswered questions for marketers and for people and consumer behavior were multiplied 3- and 5-fold over that 6-month period. And then we had the second pandemic, which we can talk about and we'll get there, which was about human rights and about racial inequality. And it was, there was this period where both were boiling at the same time, which was an unprecedented thing. And again, people needed insights. It needed to be as sharp as possible because we had to, exponentially push the formula to be of real use to marketers. And it really paid off because we had a ton of use and a ton of recognition and a ton of new users. And it's really been a heck of a ride. We're a little tired, but, we like to think we're young and strong. So we're going to keep on keeping on.
Well, let's chunk this out a little bit. Next week I am talking to David Cohn of the IAB. And as we embrace connected TV and the intersection of, online technology and TV on every platform, how do the IAB and the VAB either work together, have any overlaps, or let's say compete?
What's funny is that David Cohn and I go back to the agency days as well. We merged a company that he was running called Zentropy. At that time, it was a digital entity inside of the IPG umbrella, into what I was running at a North American basis at one point, which was Universal McCann. So that's how far David and I go back. And so, I've been in the same media ecosystem with David for a long time, and he's a friend, and he's someone I like a lot. I think that the way that I see this is, again, I try to see everything through consumer glasses and through advertiser glasses. And anything that makes something more complex inside of this ecosystem is not helping anybody. So the way that I look at the world is that video distributed on, every way that ad-supported video can be activated is the domain of our insights. And the IAB, their heritage really came through a lot having to do with the digital supply chain. And, they've got a research arm as well, but they're much more of what they've done has been about standard setting, has been about supply chain, has been about having to deal with, you know, profound supply chain issues and trying to get ahead of them and trying to, you know, a constantly moving, undulating, you know, frankly, very complicated supply chain is something that has really kept them busy for a very long time. And they deal with public policy as well. We're laser focused on insights that, you know, are about consumer behavior that help marketers grow their business. Obviously, where we all come together are things like, you know, cross-platform measurement, things like that. But there is more than enough room for both organizations. It's been an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it's interesting also because when I think about it, you're really legacy media that has moved into brave new territory. And the IAB was formed out of quote unquote new media that is also moving into multiple platforms as well. So I can see that you're important bedfellows. So let's go back on your focus and, you know, your description of premium video and things like that. But I want to start out by asking about the impact of jigsaw puzzles, or perhaps in your case, fishing. I know that's a big hobby of yours. I think it's probably a pretty safe activity for social distancing. And, you know, I'm kidding about that. But what I mean is that we're all finding ways to entertain ourselves in these COVID times. And you talked about how production has had to change. What about specifically consumer viewing habits, how we watch, what we watch? Let's discuss that aspect specifically during COVID-19.
So what I think COVID-19 did was this. I think it folded the map to give us a view of what a years from now future might have looked like without the accelerant of COVID-19. One, it accelerated a dynamic that we have believed in, and all of, you know, everyone who is, you know, the programmer, network, publishers, the people who supply the content, and then the MVPDs who distribute the content, I've always realized that this is about the idea that I simplified down, you know, to what I call arm's length moments notice with respect to video, and the contract really that the programmers and the distributors have with the consumer with respect to highest quality video. When you make an episode and you're a network, you have to make 98 versions of that one 30-minute episode because of all the platforms it goes to. And what we saw was an explosion of, you know, of video consumption, you know, sort of unlike anything we'd seen in terms of an accelerant. We did a lot of research around how open people were to now trying to find out all of the features inside of their connected TV. How does this thing actually work? What can I actually do with this? We saw so much trial of both SVOD and AVOD, and we saw, you know, 36% of the population bought an SVOD subscription for the first time. 35% of them tacked on AVODs. And we've been seeing how does the dynamic of more and more video work? And what we're finding is that people are just creating more minutes and more hours daily for the consumption of video. Inside of this whole thing, at the hub in the center of the wheel, was linear TV. And what was interesting was that the primacy of linear TV at the same time, while people were, you know, watching more streaming than ever before, who were using more connected TV features than ever before, who were, you know, buying an SVOD subscription, at the same time, these people were using linear TV as a mission critical device in their lives in some ways like never before. I mean, three statistics that I'll tell you quickly from As Time Goes By, which is a study we did that was looking at how media's effect and the role of media for people getting through COVID. Some of the things I remember, 83% of all the respondents says they could not have imagined having gotten through the stay-at-home period of COVID without a television. 67% said it was the focal part of their household. 61% said they had at least one TV set permanently turned to the news. Okay. And asked specifically, like anthropologically, how are you getting through? 29% of the respondents said friends and family. 44% said video games. And, you know, 70 some odd percent said, how I'm getting through? Television and movies.
100% for me.
And to me, what's interesting is when we fold the map, What we just get is more rampant athletic multi-screen video consumption where people want what they want when they want it on whatever terms are most convenient to them for that specific use case. And what we see is more and more consumption. And at the center of it, as we go forward, continues to be the thing with the largest scale of all of it is linear TV. And so to me, we folded the map probably a couple of years. And, you know, here we are with all of that concurrent linear strength where people are connected daily in scale at any given minute. And they're doing all of that incremental behavior.
I was one of those very fortunate people because I'm such a big TV consumer. My next door neighbors were the last people to get movers in to move them out right before lockdown happened. And they had to move in such a hurry. They bequeathed me their 55-inch beautiful TV that I got hung on the wall and I kowtowed to almost every day. So that is my absolute joy and my distraction. So what's happening with marketers who are trying to reach people like me who consume, you know, linear and on my laptop and on mobile, et cetera? What's happened with ad spend in the first half of the year?
It's interesting and probably counterintuitive. And one of the things I'll tell you was that we had for 2019 taken a look at this. And what was interesting to us about 2019 is that, you know, we had an influx of about $500 million or so and 100 some odd new advertisers who had never been on TV. 50% of them were DTCs. And some of the other things we were seeing was that, you know, not only were the e-commerce slash DTCs a $4 billion business, but FANG, you know, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you know, was now the second largest advertiser on TV. I tell you these things because as we sit here and as we've just completed, you know, the count and taking a look at, you know, what the ad spend trends are, and having heard and having seen the printed word that, you know, everything from implosion to disruption to, you know, all sorts of scorched earth predictions having to do with, you know, with video advertising and TV advertising, the numbers are eerily the same, which is staggering as a headline, if you think about what we've been through from, you know, March till now. And so what does that mean? What does that mean is that there were roughly 460 million in new advertisers to TV in the first half of 2020. And that's 111 brands. That's 59 categories new to TV. What else happened? E-commerce, again, an explosion from existing brands who suddenly needed to find other ways of getting their products, you know, safely, responsibly, and profitably to consumers who were, you know, under different directions. And so you had an explosion of established brands with e-commerce. You had new DTCs. You had DTCs and e-commerce brands who now doubled down at the same time. And you've seen, if you are, you know, even a casual consumer of television and, you know, see and, you know, watch ad-supported TV, you'll probably think to yourself that every third or fourth ad is within that FANG family. And you'd be right, because whether it's Google or whether it's Amazon, Apple, that has been, you know, a boon in terms of, you know, yet again this year, more money. So I think that that is one of the things that continues to, you know, catch people off guard. And I don't know why. And it is the not only the phenomenal persistence, but the phenomenal thriving that's done inside of, you know, the linear TV and all its extensions and all the, you know, ecosystem that we have, any way that you can serve an ad-supported impression. And it just has to do really with activating consumers in scale. And again, when all of these advertisers wanted to make statements and take a stance, whether that, you know, was COVID related or whether that was about racial injustice. You know, as I said, we had 690 campaigns that were COVID related that, you know, no one had in their business plans in February. And by June, almost 700 had been launched. So to me, it's about the fact that you get, you know, a scale audience of people are engaged where there's a, you know, contract in terms of advertising, it's anticipated because of all the targeting tools we have. There's higher value to it. And, you know, and this is a habitual behavior that's only expanding in terms of premium video consumption.
Well, the challenge with that also is something where simplification gets very meta. So, you know, there's the simplification that the VAB does to explain the state of measurement. But there are also marketers who are really seeking simplicity. And I want to know about the progress of aggregated or cross-platform measurement. What happens? Where are we at? And what happens if it doesn't happen?
Oh, it's going to happen. It has to happen. And a lot of it has to do, obviously, with data stuff and technical things and things about platforms and matching and mismatching and the things we can do as an industry. And look, there have been more advances with respect to data and data connectivity and having real agility in terms of data platforms. There's probably been more that's happened in the last 5 years. It's staggering how much advancement we've had. Where we're going to, you know, probably need to do the difficult work, and you know, everyone's ready to do it, is the establishment of standards. You do have to come with advertisers' goals in mind and really hitting things that are, you know, where the arbiter of how you set standards is what's going to advance an advertiser's business. And so I think those are the conversations that are left to have. But the priority is high. There has been an inordinate amount of, you know, all of the tough legwork and all the schematics and, you know, all of the technical things are inching closer to, you know, realization. It isn't about, you know, anyone wanting to be a holdout. It's about all of the difficult legwork needing to get done is, you know, largely in, you know, the stretch run, if you will. And now I think it's about the intellectual agreements having to do, you know, with standards that we want to set for advertising. And I think because of the fact that everyone knows this is going to push businesses forward, everyone's motivated to get it done.
In a slight sidebar to that, do you think that we're moving towards or will move towards more attention or engagement-based ways of measuring media value?
I think that's one of them. I think that's one of the dimensions is, you know, is attention. The other to me is performance, is attribution, is results in terms of, you know, the relative media value and what the value of these instruments are. You know, it's interesting. We've looked at, you know, engagement a few different ways. And one of the ways we've looked at it is, you know, through social media and, for example, on Twitter. And that to this day and to this moment, if you look at the top 10, you know, trending Twitter topics on any given evening, and I don't mean video topics or advertising topics or TV topics, I mean anything. 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10 are about ad-supported TV. The scale of people who care to the point of reaching in and typing something can't be matched. The other thing that we look at, and one of the reasons I think that we're fascinated by the direct-to-consumer category, is, you know, when there is so much competition for consumer attention, and it's such a precious commodity, there are so many, if you will, options that consumers have. One of the things that we find fascinating about these direct-to-consumer advertisers is that they have the best data analytics of anyone in the country, anyone in the world. These companies are tech companies first and data analytic companies first, and then they figure out what product they want to market. And what you find is we've seen them, you know, just pouring money hand over fist into TV advertising because it works. And so you skip past the, are people engaged? Are they paying attention? You know, or are they, you know, are they distracted? To when someone is making a purchase selection, when someone is going to your website, when someone's buying something, when they're a productive lead and that's being generated and they've got the science and the data and the analytics to tell down to the specific airing of a specific ad, just how productive it is. When you see that the life cycle of all these DTCs is they start on digital, they start on social. And then to get big, to hit any of their business goals, to get any kind of scale, they come to TV and they never leave. So to us, when we look at this instrument and we're thinking about its value and we're thinking about things like attention and connectivity, yeah, we follow it two ways. One, it's a predominant part of the American conversation on Twitter every night, shows you the scale of attention. But then the real payoff of attention, which is transaction. And all the evidence is there, the combination of DTC and FANG, that those together are that's the largest classification of advertisers in the country, and it's growing like crazy.
Well, I will take a page from the VAB's goal of simplification and say it seems to boil down to money talks, BS walks. Would that be it?
Yeah. Again, this brings me down back to all that matters is that it works and works now and is working for my future. And that comes down to all the car dealers I've ever met, all the franchisees I've ever met, all the people who are running regional, you know, furniture stores. And it comes down to worldwide conglomerates with enormous customer bases like Procter & Gamble, who understand how important this instrument is. And they understand how important, you know, continuing to be really strong inside of, you know, a recession is in terms of spending. So, yeah, ultimately, it comes down to being able to say this sells more stuff.
So you mentioned P&G, and I want to get to two other topics in our short couple of minutes left. They were one of the case studies that you cited in your recent report on how brand marketers are embracing messaging of diversity and inclusion. You mentioned Nike, Toyota, Target, Denny's, et cetera. And I believe that that report talked about the value and benefit of including D&I messaging in their campaigns. Is that something that you can give us a top line on?
Sure. And multiculturalism and diversity and championing the Hispanic market, the Black market, Asian market, and all multicultural markets is not something we're new at. When I got here 17 years ago, there was already a practice at it. And we've been working at it for a long time. And the key is now that it is inside of almost every piece of output we have. One of the things that we were interested in is, you know, we're very good at, if you will, cause and effect analysis and sitting there and saying, isolating investment in ad-supported TV and a bold line to an outcome. We're very good at that science. And we've been fascinated with looking up and down the purchase funnel. And I had an idea, and it was actually by Danielle DeLauro. And her idea was, and she's our, you know, superstar, EVP. We were at a marketing conference, and she had the idea of, what if we just isolated the variable of just messaging that was committed to diversity and inclusion? Does that mere fact alone drive outcomes? And, you know, and she met and handed off to Jason Weiss's team that project, that assignment, and stayed close to them. And Jason is our SVP, head of insights. And he and his team went crazy. And they were in search of looking for ads that drove disproportionate results up and down the purchase funnel that had at their core theme diversity and inclusion, not multi-ethnic casting. And look, I think people think it's an overdue correction. And if you've seen, you know, in the last few months, there's an explosion of multi-ethnic casting, and good for the brands that are doing that. But there's a difference between swapping out the talent in your ads and an ad that specifically, you know, goes to core messaging about brand values having to do with inclusion and about diversity. And they scoured over 3,300 ads until they were able to find ones that were so clearly brands that the entire, you know, message was, you know, about diversity. And what we were able to do was see, how did that ad perform among an advertiser's array of ads? You know, if Target had 296 ads that they ran nationally in a year, discrete ads, you know, feature benefit, that type of thing, product performance, some kind of daily sale, how did the ad that they ran, where it was specifically about, you know, supporting a woman with a small company who was a Black woman who, you know, Target became a champion for getting her distribution, getting her on the shelves, and, you know, helping her build her brand. How did that ad do against the 296 other ads they ran? Well, it ranked eighth, for example, out of that field. And then we took a look at what was, for example, if we looked at all these different types of ads, how did they do in terms of ad duration? How long did people hang in there? Was the messaging compelling, or did people kick out? We looked at, how did it drive with respect to that specific execution? How did it drive website traffic? And we looked at a five-year time period, and we wound up with 22 case histories, and we've got more. But we were able to take what I call brands all the way from Coca-Cola to Zola. And we were looking at new brands. We were looking at established brands. And we wanted to understand just one variable. If we could just prove that an advertiser's obvious commitment to, as a core message, diversity and inclusion drives better business results. Wouldn't that be an important thing for the conversation? Because that was unknown. That was unclear. Well, now it's clear through the 22 case histories we were able to do. And Procter & Gamble was one of them. Toyota RAV4 is another one. You know, 13 Spanish language, you know, executions and putting, you know, $22 million against that and having the ads be about diversity and championing that. Yeah, that's RAV4 is the number one selling SUV in the country. And they had a 42% growth over the period of time that we looked at their commitment to that. So, and again, to me, the way of being part of the multicultural marketing conversation for a while, the VAB, we've always believed, don't do it because it's a nice thing to do, you know, or the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do because it'll build your business. Do it because it's the smart thing to do. And I think that people in an era where growth is so hard to find and we're also in a recession, the brands that are going to win a lot of these categories are the brands that are going to really push chips in on that Black audience, on that Hispanic audience, on showing a commitment to diversity and inclusion. You just have to have the courage to push the chips in and then watch your brand grow.
Well, it is right there on the VAB site. So I think that's tremendous and beautifully put. And speaking of growth and economic challenges, I just want to wind this up with a word to those trying to get into the business. Here we are. Jobs are perhaps hard to get. Kids are graduating college and moving back in with their parents. What's the hope for the job scenario within the video industry?
Yeah, we're in a time where there are less jobs. Agencies have eliminated jobs. You know, everyone in the ecosystem has had to eliminate jobs. So there's fewer. I think, though, that what at the end of the day, to me, it's about the demonstration of a hunger in terms of a skill set. And to me, the greatest combination of skill sets I think you can have is, one, what I call being a detective. One of the greatest strategists I ever worked with had a mantra that I just stuck inside my forehead and I think about every day and I act that way. And it is, assume nothing, question everything. And from the beginning, one of the things I was told was how I was going to get a job, how I was going to get attention, how I was going to move on, was to constantly deliver at least 30% more on every task that I was asked about. And the way to do that was to be a detective and not to assume anything until it was proven a fact, and to think like a detective, to not fill in any of your own blanks because somebody says so. Go find the facts. If you can't go find the facts, interrogate why the fact isn't there, or find a way of fielding a study that gives you the facts. So to me, having the intellectual curiosity with the stick-to-itiveness and the relentlessness of a bulldog in saying, you know, almost like a journalistic way of looking at things and a detective way of looking at things. And that is, I'm going to over-deliver 30% on anything I'm asked because I'm going to act like a detective. I'm going to think like a journalist. I'm going to interrogate everything down to the ground. And then I'm going to take an initiative that somebody didn't ask me to do, and I'm going to hand them this every time I'm asked to do something. And it works on all sides of the desk. It's how brand managers, you know, become category managers. You know, it's how agency stars become corner office agency people. You know, it to me, that's the secret formula. It's how the you know, our people have risen through the ranks is, you know, chronic over delivery based on thinking and acting like a detective and writing like a journalist.
Well, Sean Cunningham, I think that you over-delivered on this podcast episode. Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
We got pages out of your mind and into the airwaves. So thank you for that.
It was my pleasure. And I so enjoyed talking with you, and I'm looking forward to listening to the other 19. It'll be fun.
Thank you. Well, I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I also hope that you'll rate, review, subscribe wherever you download your podcasts. You know the drill. Apple, Stitcher, Google, iHeart. Thanks again for listening.